nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay. So, as you remember, the last couple of days, I think what we ended up with was this equation describing how to calculate the current flow through a small device. So what we are talking about is, you know, some generic small device, which basically looks like a field effect transistor, which is, of course, the central device that's used in all kinds of electronic switching applications. And what it consists of is some active region called the channel with two contacts that you call the source and the drain, and current flows from source to channel to the drain. And what this third terminal does, it's called the gate. What that terminal does is it allows you to control the current flow through this. And ideally, not much current should be flowing there. All it does is control the current. And as I explained in the first day, that our general understanding of these things has kind of progressed top down, in the sense that 20 years ago, it wasn't really clear what to expect when these things were small. And they were usually tens of microns. Whereas today, the commercial transistors are like hundreds of atoms long. Okay. And in order to understand devices on that scale, it's really more useful to have a bottom-up view where you actually start from small things and try to work your way up. And that's kind of what this course tells you. And in that sense, it's very different from 305, where you learn the top-down viewpoint. Okay. Now, as we discussed, the essence of current flow then is that you need to have states around the chemical potential. So the idea is that at equilibrium, there is some common electrochemical potential which separates the filled states from the empty ones. And so what I've drawn here is like the density of states in the channel. So this axis is E. What this axis gives you is the density of states. And typically in many materials, what you have is a density of states in some energy range, then a region where there aren't any states, and then there is a region where you have some states. So I've kind of drawn a generic thing. Now, what we'll be doing in most of October, actually, is discussing the density of states in all kinds of materials, like nanotubes, graphene, silicon, different types of materials that are currently being studied. And we'll talk about where that comes from, how you think about it. At this time, all we're trying to do is, given a density of states, how do you calculate the current? And the idea then is that current flows because you have these two contacts which are held at two different electrochemical potentials, mu1 and mu2, which define this Fermi function. As I mentioned, at zero temperature, the Fermi function is zero above mu and one below mu. And when you raise the temperature sum, it wants to spread out like so. And what we have is two different chemical potentials. And so the Fermi functions in the two contacts, F1 and F2, are different. And current flows because this contact kind of wants to fill up these states and puts electrons in. This contact wants to pull them out because it would like to make it empty. And so electrons keep coming in and going out. And that's how current flows. And the expression, the quantitative expression that we obtained last day for the current is this one. What it says is, think of a small energy range dE. Then the number of states you have in that energy range is the energy range times the density of states. Because the density of states tells you how many states you have per electron volt. And this tells you how many electron volts, what range you are talking about. So when you multiply it, that tells you how many states you got. Each state would carry an amount of current, which is Q gamma over 2 H bar that we discussed. And the current is also weighted by this difference between the Fermi functions and the two contacts. Because if those two things were equal, there would be no current flow. The only reason current flows is because this has it wants to fill it up and that wants to empty it because of this essential difference between F1 and F2. So that's the driving term that goes in there. And as I mentioned, usually, of course, we are talking of current flow because of an applied voltage. But another way current could flow under some circumstances is when there's no voltage, but there's a temperature difference. That's what you call a thermoelectric current. Okay. And for this first homework, what I ask you to do is, we give you a density of states and a gamma, and what you have to do is calculate the current flow when a voltage is applied or when the temperature is different. And you do it by evaluating this numerically. Write a MATLAB code for that. Okay. Now, today what I'd like to talk more about, to go on from here, and this actually, although this is quite useful for small voltages, especially if you want to talk about current flow under large voltages, like, you know, usually a transistor would operate with like 1 volt across it. So typical supply voltages would be like 1 volt. So if you want to describe the current versus voltage over a wide range of voltages, then this needs to be supplemented with something. And that's kind of what we'll be talking about. Now, before I go on, let me just remind you of one thing, and that is that when we go to small voltages, the thing is that this F1 minus F2, if you look at this thing here, then the F1 minus F2 looks something like this. Where you're going from mu1 to mu2. In this region, the difference between them is approximately 1 because F1 is 1 and F2 is almost 0. So there is an energy range between mu1 and mu2 where it's almost 1 and it's 0 outside. And then there's some smearing over KT, like we discussed. Now, if the density of states is approximately constant in that range, then you see you can easily evaluate this by saying, well, it's Q gamma over 2H bar, and the density of states is a constant, so I can just pull it out. So whatever that is, so I'll just pull that out of this whole thing. And then you say, well, integral dE, this function. So what is the integral of this function? Well, it's roughly speaking, you see it's 1 here, 0 here. So what's the integral means? I'm looking at the area under this thing. So how much is that? Just mu1 minus mu2, which is basically the voltage Q times V. Because, as you know, the separation between the two electrochemical potentials, that's this applied voltage here. That's this QV. So you could write it this way. So if your voltage is small enough, that within this range, actually, the density of states is approximately constant. Then you see you get a very simple expression that tells you current is proportional to the voltage. And we take current divided by voltage, you'd get the conductance. So you could write I, that's I, and I could just divide by V from here, take that off of there. So what would be left would be the conductance. And this is what I discussed earlier. So the conductance was something like this. You know, I think we wrote this as Q square over 2H bar, and then there's a D times gamma. Now, and Q square over H, that's this quantum of conductance, as I mentioned before. Okay? Q square over, and H is 2 pi H bar, so you could put a pi here, that way this would become H, and put and add a pi there if you want. You could do that. Then, so this is the quantity that determines what the conductance of something small would be, you know, in terms of this quantum of conductance. Now, when you have something really small, like you had a level here which got broadened out, then as we discussed, often because of the broadening, the density of states is like 1 over gamma, and this amounts to about 1, which is why the conductance was just that much. Now, in general, one thing, let me just point out before we go on, and this is something we'll discuss more later after we have talked about density of states, is this. That you see, one thing you expect is that when you get to large conductors, the conductance should obey Ohm's law. So what you expect is, well, when you go to big things, conductance should be some conductivity times area divided by length. And you might say, well, how would that come out of this expression? You know, this is the bottom-up view where we started from small things. We said the conductance is proportional to d times gamma. Now, what if I were applying this to a big conductor? And the answer would be something like, well, if you go to big things, then the result is that the density of states is proportional to the volume. This is a general thing that if you take a solid, something like this, and take something that's twice as big, volume, then in this, what you'll have is twice as many energy levels. So if you look at the, in any energy range, if you look at how many states you got, you'll have twice as many of them. Now, this, of course, applies only when you get to big things, where, you know, you have lots of states that are very close together. That's when it approximately doubles. On the other hand, when you get to small things with states far apart, there is no simple rule then where exactly the states would be. It's just that in big things, it works that way. So what happens is the density of states tends to go as area times length when you get to big things. So that would tell you that the conductance here, you know, this is a constant, of course, and that thing's area times length. Well, that might tell you that the conductance is going as area times length, which doesn't sound right, because you see, when you get to big things, it ought to be area divided by length, you see? Okay. Now, what happens is something like this. Now, when you get to a large conductor, question is, what is this gamma? Now, the way we define the gamma is something like this, that if I put an electron somewhere in here, somewhere out here, how long does it take before it escapes into the contact? And when you have something really small, then of course how fast it escapes into the contact will depend on how good that interface is, can it get out easily, what states you have, etc. On the other hand, if you had a long conductor, like this was, say, a carbon nanotube that was, you know, a micron long, this is a long piece of conductor. Then you see how long it takes depends on how long it takes to get from here to there. It's really, but once it gets there, getting out is relatively easy. The real rate determining thing is how long it takes. On the other hand, when you had really small things, that's when that's not the issue. The issue is how to get out. I mean, the question is, where's the traffic jam? Is it here or there, right? And when you get to big things, the determining time is just how long it takes you to get through. Now, in that case, what happens is that the gamma tends to be proportional to, rather, right, gamma over h bar. That's the rate, that's like per second, and that is actually equal to the velocity divided by the length. Because how long does it take to get through the channel? Well, it's the length of the channel divided by the velocity. And you want to know how many per second, so you invert it. So it's V over L. That's it. Now, the point is then that when I multiply the two, you see the length cancels out. And so the conductor has a conductance that's proportional to the area. Okay? Now, you might say, well, this doesn't look like, still doesn't look like Ohm's law. You at least got the area in there. That's nice, because you expect that you make something twice as big, you should have twice as much current, twice as much conductance. That's in the right direction. But there's no length in there yet. And the reason is that what we have assumed here is what you'd call a ballistic conductor. Ballistic conductor in the sense, you see, in the first day I mentioned that when you have small conductors, the way an electron gets from one end to the other is it goes straight through, like a bullet. That's this ballistic idea, right? On the other hand, when you get to big conductors, the ones where Ohm's law is supposed to hold, you know, those are supposed to be big ones, there you see it goes more like this. That's different. Now, you see, if an electron is going around like this, then, as you can see, that doesn't make much sense. When I write the time it takes to get through a region is length divided by velocity, that assumes ballistic transport. That kind of assumes that it goes straight through. Then, no, that's the length, so divide by velocity tells you the time. See? So, the answer we got here, namely that D is proportional to AL, gamma is proportional to 1 over length, and so the conductance is proportional to the area, that statement holds for ballistic conductors. Okay? And that's a fact, that you see when you have the carbon nanotubes, a micron long, tend to be ballistic, and the thing is if you make it half a micron or 1 micron, the resistance is about the same. It doesn't depend on the length. Whatever resistance you measure is the contact resistance, interface resistance. Yes.
In this case, you are saying that current depends on the voltage that we apply to the gate, right? We can change the current by changing the
gate.
We apply the gate, right?
Gate meaning this one.
That's right.
Right, but that's a separate issue. When right now we are talking about the V. The way this one comes in is it simply moves these density of states up and down. The way that voltage works, right? So for this discussion, we're assuming that we got some fixed voltage there, and so we have got some given density of states here, and we are doing this calculation. And the way you could control the current flow would be, like if I put a negative voltage on this and raise all this up so that there is no density of states in this region. You know, so because this part kind of moves up here, then there would be no current. That would be like turning the transistor off.
Does current flow even though we apply the zero bias?
No. Current always, right. Under, as long as the temperatures are the same and the voltages are the same, even if you have lots of states here, if you have no states, of course, even when you put a voltage, nothing will happen. But if you have lots of states here, that's reflected in this. No current can flow unless F1 and F2 are different. So finally, what current you get will depend on two things. One is whether you have states, and that's what you control with a gate voltage. And secondly, whether there is a driving term, there is a difference between the two contacts, the F1 and the F2. Right? So this is where so usually in describing a transistor, you talk of two kinds of voltages, right? The drain voltage and the gate voltage. Usually you plot current versus one of them, keeping the other one constant. That's how you usually look at these things. And the gate voltage really is kind of affecting the density of states, while the drain voltage is what gets in there, changes your Fermi functions, because it changes this mu 1 and mu 2. Okay? Yes.
You said the gamma over H bar is equal to the velocity of the electron over the length of the channel. What does that velocity of
Yeah, not so much on the voltage really. It is more like in these states here, when you have an electron in there, what velocity does that? So when you have electrons inside a solid, usually what happens is that different states in here are associated with different velocities. Namely, if you had an electron in that state, it could be moving at some speed. Or it could be moving in the opposite direction at some speed. And normally you don't have current because one cancels the other. But in this case, because your stuff coming in from this side, all that gets occupied is the ones that are going this way. But so I'd say that velocity is characteristic of the states in there. So the two inputs that you kind of want about any material in this case is, firstly, what density of states you have, how many states you have, and secondly, how fast those states move. Because you, for example, you could have a material and you have lots of states, but if you put an electron in one of those states, it just doesn't go anywhere. It just stays there. Then it wouldn't conduct very well. So what really matters is this product of density of states and how fast they move. And what we'll be talking about in October, essentially, all of October, is starting from Schrodinger equation, talking about different types of materials and what the density of states is and what density of states times the velocity, what that's called the number of modes, what that is. Because those are the two things that you need to know about any material. And so that we'll be getting into in October. Okay. Okay. So the point I was trying to make here then is that the conductance of a ballistic conductor is actually independent of length, ideally. You could make it twice as long, it's still the same, because it all comes from the two ends, it's the contacts, you see. Now, the way you could get Ohm's law is, of course, you'd have to kind of do this a little more carefully. That is, the time it takes to actually escape from your channel is not, does not depend on the length, but what you can show is that if an electron is indeed moving this way, then the time it takes is actually proportional to L squared. This is what you call a diffusive motion. And in that case, the time it will take is not being proportional to length, but to L squared. What that means is here, you'd actually have something divided by L squared. You don't need to go into it right now. Actually, that something is what's called the diffusion coefficient. Okay? Actually, there are two here. But the point is that once you put an L squared, then you can see that the L squared and the AL together would give you Ohm's law. So that's just to connect up to how you would get Ohm's law out of this if you're going. Okay. But for ballistic conductors then, the right thing to use is V over L. And in that case, the important quantity you want to know is what's the density of states and what's the velocity and what's the product of the two. Okay. Okay. So this conductance formula then is really just a special case of the more general thing. So this is what you could use in general. But if the density of states is approximately constant in your energy range of interest, then you could go here, etc. So these are all kind of special cases that follow from there. Okay? Okay, now what I'd like to do is then point out what's missing here. That's what we want to talk about. And for this purpose, a good question to ask is, supposing you had a material like this, where, let's say, for this discussion, I'll assume the density of states is actually constant. Above a certain energy. So some fixed value here, whatever you like to call it, say D, but then it goes to zero right there. And this is actually a good approximation to an N-type transistor, because if you have taken 305, you possibly know that there is in N semiconductors, there's this conduction band edge, and then there's a density of states above it. Now, of course, it's not exactly constant. It might be somewhat changing like this. So I've idealized it, said, well, for this discussion, let's just think of it as constant. But basically, the idea is that you have states above a certain energy, none below it. I mean, you actually have a valence band somewhere out here, but that's so far away, it doesn't matter in this discussion. So as far as we are concerned, all that matters is this part. So the question is, what does the current versus voltage look like? Okay. So at equilibrium, you had a single chemical potential that's somewhere here. And then when you apply a voltage, what you're doing is pushing this up a little bit, pulling this down a little bit. They separate by Q times V. So you pull up one by, say, half QV. The other one, you pull it down by half QV, let's say. So what would happen then is, and current flows, of course, because you got states in here that can start carrying current, the part that lies between mu 1 and mu 2. And again, for this discussion, to keep things simple, let's not even worry about the temperature, the fact that things are rounded out a little bit. Okay, we'll assume we're just thinking zero temperature. So what I claim then is that the current should just keep increasing like this. Should it just be linear, or do you expect something else? Well, if you look here, it's like I'm gradually pulling this down, pushing this up, and more states are coming into the picture. Okay, but then at some point, this one is going to cross this, and it will come down here. So at that point, of course, I'll stop opening up any new states down here, because I've already crossed the bandage, there's nothing more there. But then on this side, of course, I'll still keep picking up more and more. So what would happen then is, this would kind of increase linearly up to a point, and then it would increase with half the slope. Because at first, you see, you're opening up states on both sides. Then, so right here, it's like you've opened it up a little bit on this side and a little bit on that side. But then once you have crossed the bottom here, you only pick up states on one side, not the other. Okay? So the slope kind of goes this way and then half. Okay? And if you think of it the other way, like if I had actually put a voltage the other direction, you'd have exactly the same thing in reverse. So it would look kind of symmetric. Now, the thing is, that's not what a transistor actually looks like. Right? Actually, the current versus voltage looks more like this, ideally. In fact, let me just draw it on top of this, that way it will be clear. Yeah, rather than drawing it separately, let me just draw it on top of this. I don't see chalk with a different color, so I just draw it as solid. The thing is, what happens is that it would actually, go with some slope, and then instead of going to half the slope, it would actually just level off, ideally. Now, question is, why is that? Okay. Now, the crucial point is this. You see, there's one thing that I kind of slipped into this discussion without quite justifying it, and that's this. Of course, when I apply a voltage, the two electrochemical potentials separate by Q times V. And then I say, well, so this is half QV and this is half QV. Now, that isn't quite obvious. Why did it really have to be 50-50? You see, the difference is QV, of course. You put a voltage here, so the mu 1 and mu 2 are separated by QV. But then, how do I know that it's will go 50-50, half here and half there? Why not, say, 10% and 90%, for example? And the point is that to make a good transistor, you actually would ideally like it to go 0 here and all of it on this side. That's what you'd really like it to do. You see, because, if you do that, then what would happen is it would work something like this. So at equilibrium, your mu is somewhere here. So let us say the voltage drops not 50-50, but more like this is held right where it is, and this just gets pulled down. Then you see what would happen is this is held right where it is. You pull it down, current increases up to a point, then when you cross this, it stops. That's it. So you'd actually have then more, so like I had drawn it, at some point just level off completely. And that's what you really want in a good transistor, actually. That makes circuit design and all that much easier. That is, you'd like to have a current that at some point, is independent of this voltage, so that if you have a bigger drain voltage, current doesn't change anymore. So how do you make it, you know, not go 50-50, but go all of it on one side? Now, that's where this electrostatics comes in. The whole idea is that you say, I'm putting, roughly speaking, you see, we are thinking of the source as, say, the reference. We'll call that the ground. You know, after all, it's only potential differences that matter. So I can always take any particular point as my zero. So let's say this is zero. And I put 1 volt here. And the question you're asking is, what is the potential around here? Now, of course, the potential will be different on the left side and on the right side. But for this discussion, I'm assuming I got a short enough channel that I could lump this whole thing and talk about some average potential in that region. I'm thinking of it as some small region. But the main point is, I've got a contact here and a contact here, 0, 1. What's it in between? Now, one way to see this would be that you see, if this gate, you know, that's like a ground plane. And if this gate were really close, then you would expect that putting 1 volt here has hardly any effect on the potential in here. Because, you know, you got this gate holding the potential tight right there. And that's really what a good transistor has to do. A good transistor needs to have a gate that is electrostatically so close to the channel that when you put a voltage here, the potential in the channel does not change at all. And so what happens is this stays fixed with respect to the source, and all that happens is you pull the drain down. That's it. Whereas the way I have assumed it so far is that the drain is getting pulled down and the source is going up. But then if you think of the source as your reference, that's sort of like saying, okay, the source is zero, and if I put 1 here, then the channel goes down by half. I kind of say that, well, let's take this as the reference and say this was half and this was minus half. So we took the channel as the reference and said half and half either way. But that's equivalent to saying, if I had taken this as the reference, that's like saying that the channel goes about halfway down when I pull the drain down. That's kind of what it is. And that would be a really bad transistor, you see, if you haven't designed it right. Because the art of designing a good nanotransistor or good any transistor really is to have a gate that really controls the potential inside the channel. And that really is the hard part, you see, of designing small transistors, because I mentioned the other day that these days, this length is like hundreds of atoms, like 500 atoms, 600 atoms. Now, the thing is that if this is 600 atoms and you want the potential to be controlled by the gate, then it's extremely important that the gate be really close to the channel. And the rule of thumb is it has to be like, say, a 50th of that. So what I mean by that is when you have a insulator here, you know, and people are nowadays trying to make wraparound insulators, so the entire channel is kind of surrounded by that gate all around. Then the thing is, that insulator thickness has to be tens of atoms. Because in the past, of course, this could have been 50, 100 atoms. You know, it could have been much bigger. But now, you see, if you had it 100 atoms, what would happen is when you apply a voltage here, the gate would not be able to hold the potential. This would kind of slip down. It wouldn't work. And you'd end up with current versus voltage looking more like that rather than that one. And that's true, actually. I mean, with small transistors, it's getting harder and harder to keep them flat this way. So you look at the transistors back from 20, 30 years ago, they tended to have, you know, characteristics that were more like this. Today's ones tend to be more like that, actually. And people are learning to kind of deal with it, but then you can only handle this kind of thing up to a point. You do want to have this saturation. Okay. So the difficult part, as I said, is how to make that oxide tens of atoms. Because once you make it 10, the problem is, of course, you have lots of leakage current through it. Because, you know, ideally, you don't want any current to flow here. All you want is that this terminal controls the electrostatic potential inside. That's it. So you really want this insulator to be thick enough that you have no tunneling currents. And the fact is, again, nowadays they have to make it so small that there is a significant amount of leakage current in the gate, which is a problem. So the hard part is not so much making this small down to hundreds of atoms. Hard part is making that small and doing that repeatably, you know, in a controlled way over billions of transistors. Really? Okay. Okay. Now, in this context, of course, we, as I said, in this course in general, we really won't be talking too much about one device or another because, as I said, the course is really more about how to think about small things, really. Okay. Now, in this context, then, the main point I wanted to make is that there is something about this equation that needs to reflect this thing that I just discussed. That you see, this equation says I've got a density of states here and then F1 minus F2. But the thing is that when I apply a voltage here, this channel has some potential, let's call it, say, U. And that, as a result of that potential, this density of states can kind of go up or down somewhat. And that needs to be included into this equation, which as yet it doesn't have. That's all I'm saying. So now, in this context, the one thing to remember is that usually when you write V, that's potential. When I write U, I mean potential energy. And the two are this opposite signs usually. What I mean by that is, if you have a positive potential someplace, then the potential energy corresponding potential energy would be negative. Because positive potential makes it easier for electrons to go in there. On the other hand, if you have a negative potential, that corresponds to a positive U. So, okay. So when I write U here, I mean that as energy. So the thing is that if U is positive, that's like a positive potential energy corresponding to a negative potential. Then what would happen is this density of states would float up. So if you have a potential here, U, this density of states will float up by an amount, U. Okay? And that is what I need to modify this here to reflect that. So my question is, yeah, how do I do that? And usually I have these two choices. I could write this. That would be one way to do it. Or I could do this, and the question is which is correct? Supposing I have a density of states that looks like this, and I want to move it up by an amount U. So if this is D of E, question is this this or that? The first one. Okay. So this you can think about. It's not completely obvious. It's easy to get confused on this. But no, but yeah, I'm sure you have seen this before, so think about this. So you can put that in. And then we have the question of how to find the U. Right? So I need a separate equation that will tell me that given this situation, what is the U here? U, one way to do this would be that mentally people think of it as if you have something like this. You have a source, you have a drain, and you have a gate. And then you have this channel. So often you think of it like this, as if these are connected by various capacitances. And when you put different potentials on this, how much you get here, what potential you get here, is basically determined by this capacitive network. So if, for example, this capacitance were big, if this was a very big capacitance, then the potential here would be very close to that one. So what you can show is in this capacitive network, if one of these capacitors were really big, then the potential there would just go with that. So ideally, since you want the gate to really control things, you really want this to be a very high capacitance. Which is one way to make it a high capacitance is you make that arc side real thin. That's one way to get a high capacitance. Another way to get a high capacitance that people work on is what are called high-K dielectrics. And that by itself is a major field of research at this time. That is, you try to find different materials which have very high dielectric constants, you know, 100, say. Because silicon dioxide has a dielectric constant of like 4. So yet, let's say we have to make it 10 atoms thick with 4. Now, the thing is, if instead of 4 it were 40, it could have been 100 atoms thick, and still it would be the same capacitance. You see, because capacitance goes as this dielectric constant times A divided by the thickness. So if this is 10 times as much as big, you could get by with 10 times as much thickness. And then it would be easier because you wouldn't have to worry as much about tunneling and so on. And so these days people are working on all kinds of high-K materials to put on there. And that's really a major change from the past because, as you know, one of the most attractive things about silicon technology is its oxide, is the fact that you can easily grow this silicon dioxide of very high quality. And to kind of throw that away and say that we'll put a whole different, we are willing to put a whole different high-K kind of tells you how desperate things are. You see? Okay. So that would be one way to, I guess, estimate this. Actually, the right way is you solve something called Laplace equation. So this Laplace equation you solve with the appropriate boundary conditions on your electrodes and so on. But we don't need to get into that for this discussion. We can say, well, you just solve a capacitor network like this and find out what it should be. It will be some weighted average of the potential you have here, the potential you have there, and the potential you have there. So whatever that is, I'll call this U sub L. And the L is a reminder that if I'm really doing this right, I'd be solving a Laplace equation for it. Okay? So whatever that is. Now, actually, this isn't quite the full story. There's something else you have to add here, and that's what I want to explain. Okay. So, let us say we have a very good gate. So that when I put on a drain voltage, this does not slip at all. Because the potential in this channel U is essentially controlled by the gate potential. Of course, we have discussed that the source potential we could just assume to be zero, because it's only relative things that matter. I could take that as zero. And so this U in general would depend on the gate voltage and the drain voltage. But let's assume we got a perfect transistor, perfectly designed transistor, so it depends only on the gate. Good. So it doesn't slip at all. So you'd think then that the current should look something like this. And where does it saturate? Well, once it has crossed this. So you can find the amount of current, the on current. The on current would be whatever current is carried by all these states. You know, and roughly, as we discussed, the amount of current carried per state is Q gamma over 2 H bar. And then you can take the density of states, multiply it by that, and it will tell you how many states you have, tells you the on current. Okay? Now, the thing is, that the actual on current will be somewhat more than that. Not quite this. It'll be something a little bigger. And I want to explain why. Why it's a little more than what you might think. And the reason goes some like this. That now, when it was all in equilibrium, you see, you had a chemical potential that was here. All these states were full. Now what has happened is we are in a non-equilibrium situation. This one's trying to fill up these states. That one's trying to empty those states. So the thing is, when you now look at the average occupation of these states, you find they are not completely full anymore. You see, when it was in equilibrium, these were all full. And so let us say you had 100 electrons there. you know, you had 100 states, which are all full, so you had 100 electrons. Okay, now you see what's happening is this one wants trying to fill it up, that one's trying to empty it. So it's kind of half full because, you know, one comes in and goes out. So if you find the average occupation of those levels, it's like half. So the average number of electrons is not 100 anymore. It's more like 50. There's fewer electrons in there, steady state. Now, because you have fewer electrons in there, the thing is the potential around here becomes more positive or negative? More positive, because it's like there's less of negative charges. You know, these negative charges were all compensated by the positive nucleus and all that in the solid. So when you had 100 electrons, there was also 100 positive charges there, and between them it was neutral, let's say. Now you got only 50 electrons. Of course, there's 100 nucleus, they are still around. So the thing is, it now becomes positive. So this region then tends to have a positive potential. And positive potential, of course, means that this will kind of slip down a little bit because the potential is positive. And that's not quite reflected if you just solve a capacitor circuit. Because if you are solving a capacitor network and finding the potential here, that doesn't know about the fact that your number of electrons got smaller. It doesn't quite know that. So that information is not there. See? So because it can slip down some, but it won't slip indefinitely, though. It will slip a little bit, then after that it will be okay. I mean, once you got it slipped down enough that even with half filling, you can accommodate 100 electrons. After that, it won't slip anymore. So, but it will slip a little bit, you see. So what happens then is, instead of saturating around here, it saturates a little later. So the on current is a little more than what you might have thought if you hadn't let it slip. Because basically, the on current will be actually almost double. Why? Because, you see, you had 100 electrons here. Now that it is half filled, you kind of need twice as many states to have 100 electrons. Sort of. So to keep it neutral, if you will, to get 100 electrons, it will actually slip down about that. Okay. Now, for this equation then, what happens is, you have to add another term here that is proportional to the number of electrons in your channel. Number of electrons relative to the equilibrium number of electrons. So what I mean by that is, like you, as I said, when it was in equilibrium, you used to have 100 electrons. Now what do you have? So you need to look at how many you now have relative to what it used to be when it was, when everything was equilibrium. And that then is multiplied by the average potential energy, like per electron. So one electron changes the potential by, say, 1 microvolt. So you can take the number of electrons and multiply it by that. So the point is, then, the actual potential in your channel, then, has two parts. One part where you can think of it just like a capacitor network. And then there's the other part, which reflects the fact that electrons interact with each other. There's electron-electron interaction. And so if you have fewer electrons, it becomes easier for the next electron to come in. That part of it. That's what's in here. Another way to think of is that this UL is because of charges on your electrodes. Here, here, and here. So it's like the potential here due to the charges on the electrodes, whereas the second term is the potential due to the charge right there. That's another way to think about it. Okay. But the point is then that you have an equation for a current, which depends on U. And how do I find the U? Well, there's a capacitor network part, and then there's a part that depends on how many electrons I get. And to complete the story, of course, what I need to tell you is how to find the number of electrons. You see? Then I have the full thing. So what I need is one more equation here, which will tell me how many electrons I have. And that would then do it. Okay. And that equation ordinarily would have looked something like, if I had just finding the number of electrons, I'd have said, you take the density of states and fill it up according to the Fermi function, according to some Fermi function. If the thing were in equilibrium, then that's how you'd have found the number of electrons. You'd have said density of states, that tells you if it's full or not. This tells you if there's a state or not. This tells you if the state is full or not. So overall number of electrons would be given by that. But what we have here is a non-equilibrium situation. So what it means is I can't quite use a Fermi function because you see I got F1 and F2, so which one do I use? And what I'll do next day is we'll show that the correct thing to use is a weighted average of F1 and F2. And the weighting depends on how strongly it is coupled to the left and to the right. So the way I've written it is both gammas the same, it would be like half F1 plus F2. But if in general I make this gamma 1 and make that gamma 2, then the correct thing to use here would be gamma 1 F1 plus gamma 2 F2 divided by gamma 1 plus gamma 2. So this isn't meant to be obvious. This is what I'll be discussing next day. But overall then, this would be the complete set of equations that you'd have to solve in general to calculate the current versus voltage of a small conductor described by some density of states and some coupling to the two contacts, gamma 1 and gamma 2. And I guess if you have these two separate gammas, then instead of this half gamma here, the correct thing that we'll derive next day will be gamma 1, gamma 2 over gamma 1 plus gamma 2. So what I had written before was like assuming those were equal, and that's why I ended up with half gamma. But if the two are different, then what you'll find is actually this. So this is what we'll do next day, and that will then kind of complete the set of equations. Okay? So let me stop here today and have a good weekend, and we'll see you on Wednesday. Okay?